Okay, hi, good morning. I believe we reached yesterday the idea of four types of form, still dealing with Rule 9. The form of the very first one was the form of the personality, then the form of the environment, then the form of the devotee, and the last one was the form of the causal body, and there seemed to be a fifth added to it. A lot of notes. Yes, the Mayavarupa, that was the fifth form. So our rule, condensation next ensues, the fire and waters meet, the form swells and grows, let the magician set his form upon the proper path. We may have to hold this class telepathically if I can't talk. But it could be an opportunity, you know. Who would like to read this?
I'll read it if you like. In these days you will need to ponder on this matter of the form. For with the entering in of a new ray and the commencement of a new era comes ever a period of much disruption until the forms that have been have adapted themselves to the newer vibration. In that adaptation, those who have cultivated pliability and adaptability, or who have that for their personality ray, progress with less disruption than those more crystallized and fixed.
Okay, there seems to be a lot of little things going on strangely here. My arrow would not go all the way to the right. So maybe that's fixed now. The form creating ray. And we discussed yesterday the difficulty of all transitional periods. And we discussed this in terms of dissonance. We related it to Vulcan and the feeling of being alone, not on the fixed cross, not on the cardinal cross, but somewhat in dissonance with both of those crosses. We discussed the sounding of two notes and the period of inharmony, which can result depending on which two notes are sounding simultaneously. And I think that what we have here is the thought that transitions bring difficulty and disruption. And we are in the midst of a transition right now between the sixth and seventh ray and between Pisces and Aquarius. And we have the clash of two notes that do not accord with each other in many respects. Probably it's the Mercury-Uranus of Aquarius that doesn't accord well with the Pisces type of atmosphere. And yet, there are links, are there not? Because Uranus is a planet which is involved in an alignment from Sirius through Pisces, through Uranus, through the heart center, solar plexus, etc. And Neptune is one of the veiled rulers of Aquarius. It's veiled by the moon, along with Vulcan and Uranus. and it's a major ruler of Pisces, and also Jupiter is an esoteric ruler of Aquarius and a major ruler of Pisces. So there are links, and the two constellations do overlap in space, at least from our perspective. So there are ways to bridge this. I mean, if you were to apply yourself right now to saying, how can we bridge the Pisces and the Aquarian age so that there is less disruption, what kind of ideas could we come up with? Because some things are so different. You know, authority versus one's own authority and so forth. And the mystical versus the occult, very different in many ways. But are there any ways to bridge this? Yes.
The word that comes to me is dedication.
Uh-huh, okay. Dedication.
Well, in a way, they both have this feeling or sensing. You don't have the same in Aquarius, but you have a kind of dedication.
Yes. Yes, well, that is one possibility indeed.
And education.
And
education.
Education.
On all levels.
Education is needed in order to see the value of both of the signs. I'm thinking that one of the things about these two signs, in a strange sort of way, is they're both astronomical. They both consider the heavens and the larger picture. So many of the great astronomers had strong Pisces in their chart. And Aquarius, we know, studies all of these heavenly things and heavenly cycles. So I think they both have a respect for the larger environment in which we live, the non-physical environment. They share that. They're both interested in the other worlds. The other worlds for Aquarius might be more etheric, and the other worlds for Pisces might be more emotional sentient. But they are not totally worldly in the usual earth sign sense. So there is a possible bridge. They're both interested in invocation. They both are receptive. The principle of universality is strong in both. The idea of pervasiveness is strong in both. We're told about the pervasive wisdom of Pisces, and the universal love of Aquarius. So there's a love wisdom quality which could bridge them.
Mm-hmm. And true humility.
Humility.
Since I write the social,
yes, based on a larger.
Is big enough. But I think the word
religion. Sorry.
The word religion. Yeah. Maybe that will be what will be the best. Connecting the Pisces and the
Aquarius. And the Aquarius.
Maybe even
coming. The Christ must have thought it could be done.
Yeah.
Because he sort of took charge of both ages as the Savior in both ages. So we have to study him and how he's planning to take his Piscean self into the Aquarian age. And why do I say his Piscean self? Because Pisces is a cosmic decanate associated with the Christ and the second ray. So although we could say Christ has outgrown the age of Pisces, he's not outgrown the cosmic decanate which Pisces stands for. They both are somehow able to make the part become a part of the whole. They both have that ability. So wholeness is involved in both. And they stand together in a way as post-Capricornian signs, offering new possibilities. They both are deeply into service. One is service and the next is salvation. Service and salvation together. The service spirit, I think, can bridge. The lines of cleavage are pretty strong, however, because sometimes in Pisces there is the resignation of individuality, where you sort of give up your own potentials and you just let someone else guide you. And that's not so in Aquarius. Aquarius demands the individualistic fulfillment of every part of the group, at least when it's operating positively. Well, you know, how long is this overlap? We could say that it's been going on since the time of Francis Bacon, and that it will last until 2117. I think Francis Bacon is said to have died in the year 1616, something like that, very close. And the Aquarian Age begins officially 2117, that 500 years when he started Aquarianism, let's say, and when Pisces now ends. We've been in the middle of this overlap period, and I think we are almost at the point where the Piscean influence will really wane now. He says it will disappear during the 21st century. He didn't say when. I think that what are the evidences now in our society that Pisces still has strength? In our global civilization, what are the evidences?
The fundamentalism.
I think that's a very big one.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the retreat from... I would say fundamentalism, devotionalism, and in a way retreat from education, which goes along with fundamentalism. In other words, sometimes it's the wrong emphasis on humility. We are nothing. You, God, are everything. You know, man was meeting God in the Age of Enlightenment. But now we have some people wanting to retreat back into a position of the humble, incapable creature in the face of Almighty God. We can do nothing of ourselves. That attitude, it goes with, and that robs from education. Because the premise of education is that we can lift ourselves into much greater potential, undreamt of potentials. And I've noticed that there's the idea that God has all the potentials and we have none. The Aquarian idea is we have tremendous potentials and we are almost like God. And I think those two things are running against each other.
The first one, isn't it fear-based too? Because when we are saying God is all, then I don't have to do anything.
Exactly.
So I don't have to look at my own fears.
Exactly. That will be taken care of by the parental figure.
Mm-hmm.
We're just children, we're hopeless, we're helpless, and we don't have to assert ourselves. We will be taken care of.
It's mostly due to ignorance.
Yes. And look, what I pointed out was the strength of Mercury in relation to Aquarius, second decanate, and the general weakness of Mercury with respect to Pisces. Which is not to say that later Mercury is not intuitively strong in Pisces. But the normal interpretation is that Mercury, the planet of education, falls in Pisces. So right now, in all of the countries, so many of them, less and less money is given to education. And we're coming back, we're falling in our educational level. I think in some of the Scandinavian countries, it's held up pretty well. But there's a lot of pressure to spend money on other things. And I think that's one of the areas we're going to have to watch, because DK says that unless the billions spent on armaments are spent on education, we will have that next war. Because obviously the forces of ignorance could precipitate that, as people don't know how to think. So I think we've got to keep the illumination coming. As Aquarius is a very illuminating sign, and Mercury is very strong. Let's see if there's anything else. In that adaptation, until the forms have adapted themselves, in that adaptation, those who have cultivated flyability and adaptability. Okay, that's so different from rigid, fearful fundamentalism. This is a third-rate, fourth-rate attitude. Pliability and adaptability. And the other attitude we're dealing with is a sixth-ray, even primitive seventh-ray, rigid attitude.
Do you not think equality comes into that as well? Because it seems to me that there's a schism there.
You know, equality is one of the Aquarian abuses, if not understood. Because we're going to the age of liberty, fraternity, equality, all the air signs, right? Aquarius, Gemini, Libra. Liberty, fraternity, equality. But Aquarius likes to level the playing field. And hence you had communism. We're all the same. And even fascism, you give everything for the state. So the equality has to be understood as equality in the spirit and equality of opportunity, but not equality in manifestation. And that's a hard sell. Everybody is as good as everybody else. So where is the meritocracy? Where is the incentive to be more than you are if everybody's just as good as everybody else? So this is a very important word and a dangerous word at the same time. But with Libra coming stronger in the planetary horoscope, this question of equality will be before us. We have to solve it in the right way. Certainly the equality of men and women, that's a big one and a very important one. Matter of fact, I don't see how we can go into the new age without an adjustment of equality for men and women. It is paramount, and the greatest abusers and those whose way of thinking would prevent the new age way of being are for the complete inequality of men and women.
Fundamentalism is...
Well, that whole thing... Fundamentalism is Martian. Mm. It's Martian. Mm. But Atlantis might have been just as bad. There was an inequality there too. The women were the superiors in those days. So, and really, it moves towards Venus now. Venus is important. I know that the back row may think that's just great.
But you know, Venus is a combination of the masculine and feminine. So it's not more, I think it's both.
Blavatsky said that Venus used to be pictured with a beard.
China, Venus is a masculine China.
But you know, any of these great logoi, they are divine hermaphrodites. Mm-hmm. So the male-female aspect. It's just a question on any planet of how strong the Deva evolution is compared to the human. Like we live in a feminine solar system because the Deva part of it is so much more impressive than the human part. We are we human beings are outnumbered 2 1/3 to 1. 140 billion conscious deva units and 60 billion human units. And he says this is the same with planets too. They are either more devic or more human. I wonder about our own. He says our planet is in the middle, between, and that there are struggles because of that kind of equality. We haven't reached the adjustment yet. But I'm wondering about a planet like Neptune. Seems very very devic to me. I wonder about Venus, where the solar angels have such a power, whether it is not somehow more devic. I don't know the proportions, of course. Mars doesn't seem very devic to me in that sense. Okay, who will read the next part? Yeah, you be the reader.
Particularly now, should pliability and responsiveness of form be aimed at? For when he whom we all adore comes, think you his vibration will not cause disruption if crystallization is present? It was so before, it will be so again.
I think that's an amazing phrase coming from a Tibetan monk. He whom we all adore. I think that's... It puts things into proportion, you know. He says somewhere, I number myself among the humblest friends of the Christ, he says. Of course, he was also revealing an interesting thing when he said that. Does anybody know what he might have been saying? Here it is. In all reverence, and as one of his humblest friends and personal workers, I am permitted to tell you a little of his position as he nears the great event in May this year. He knows himself to be the inner spiritual commander of the armies of the Lord. Whoa, that's about the Christ. And then all the rest of what he has to do. But the term friends of the Christ is a technical term. You're familiar with that idea?
No.
I'll show you. If I can find it here. You may have your wish, there may be no singing. I know you wouldn't have sacrificed me for that wish, but
will you be around?
Will I be around? Yeah, but without a voice. Okay. Let's see. Wait a second. Maybe it's going to be in one of these. I want to find it. Friend. Christ. Wisdom. Here it is. Friend. Wait a second. Is that 1-1? Why won't this work? There's only one of one. Go backwards. Okay, try it again. Maybe it can come here. Friend Christ. Otherwise, I'll just have to tell you. Well, I don't understand this because it was such a big deal. Friends of the Christ. Well, It's not there. It's in the instructions to DHB. Let me just try friend of the Christ. Friend of the Christ. No, it's not there either. Okay, I must be just missing one word. Anyway, the idea behind it is that a friend of the Christ is a technical term for those who are on the wisdom line and who have gone through two or three very difficult incarnations and are brought into relationship with the Christ because of their capacity to approach the second ray from the wisdom line and to augment his efforts from the wisdom line. Not because they are especially loving, but they have that other quality on the second ray. So D.K. told this man, who was being prepared for the third initiation, that he was now one of the friends of the Christ, and that he had been prepared for it through... Why didn't I find that? I think it was because I was writing fiends. Another slip. So Foster Bailey, FCD, they are second ray types. One of you things that you have to do is evoke a new fiery incentive. For this reason, I have, as I seldom do, indicated the future ahead of you. You and Roberto Assagioli are both numbered among the friends of Christ. Ah, it's not the Christ, it's friends of Christ. As this special group is called, and are upon a peculiar path of training. Go ahead, Mimi, you read this.
Step by step, the nature of this path will be revealed to you, and little by little, you will perceive the quality of the unfoldments which presented opportunity can give you.
Keep going, please.
Be not mistaken, my brother. This does not mean that in this present vehicle and with your present equipment you can contact the master of all the masters. Nor does it mean that your advancement is ahead of that of your group brothers. There are those in this group and in my ashram who are ahead of you, if such inexact terms can be used. The Christ, through your own master, and in no way, through your own master, and in no other way, knows you. Not yet can you know him.
We should pause there for a minute, because this was a man being prepared for the third degree. Mm-hmm. And if D.K. says this to him about the Christ, we should apply it to ourselves. The degree of intimacy possible is limited, and yet it is being prepared. Let's see if I can find the idea here. Friends of Christ. Two of them, that's one, and the second one is the special group of the Friends of Christ, special group. And I think I'm not going to be able to find that section where he talks about specifically the wisdom line, but it is there. And when D.K. numbers himself among the Friends of Christ, among the humblest, he is meaning the same thing. He's talking about being on the wisdom line. Okay. And yet, he uses this word adore, which means a great fullness of devotion. And you know, Master D.K. has a reputation of being very devoted. You know, that's one of his things, including some humorous stories about it. But he had a great faithfulness and devotion to Master K.H., and he told us the big story about how he failed, remember that one, through his supposed devotion. He had fancied himself so devoted to his master, but the master revealed to him that a lot of that devotion was to himself, as a quite a good disciple. And so, as D.K. said, he came crashing to earth and realized that the quality his master had seen in him was correct. But still, he's incredibly devoted. He straightened all that out. And he does not minimize the value of that quality. Matter of fact, he was talking to a third-ray soul whose rays were as follows. And probably the monad was ray two. But he said, look, it's not your mind that has brought you to us. It is your devotion. So devotion counts for a lot because it has everything to do with trustworthiness and loyalty and reliability. And it's very interesting that it's after the second initiation in which the devotion angle is put in the proper place and confirmed that you establish your trustworthiness with the hierarchy. So what do you think? That if the Christ appears, it will all be nice? What kind of things do you think would break up?
It's only church.
Well, I think he's gonna need a church. But he's not going to need all the forms that we've built. Don't you think that if the Prince of Peace comes, the tendency to make war for aggressive purposes will suffer? What about our economic situation? Based on what? Often. No sharing, greed, power. That's going to see the thing that the Christ will do and that we will do in anticipation of him, he will expose what is going on. In other words, that great light and love will reveal the abuses. And people will see why things are going badly, and all of the hidden sin will be revealed. D.K. tells us people will lack the privacy in which to sin.
It's happening now, though. Exposed days all the time.
You can't get away with anything anymore.
No. Realize.
The group gaze, the omnipresent camera, the internet. I saw some funny movies. I saw a funny movie. It was with Steve Martin and Meryl Streep and Alex Baldwin. And it's all about sort of Skype. And what happens when you forget to turn your Skype off?
Or your microphone.
Or your microphone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then you hear the truth.
But right now, so much evil is hidden. But let's call it like this. The roots of evil are much hidden. But they have to be ferreted out, have to be brought to light, hence Pluto and Vulcan. Before the Christ can come, first initiation, right? Pluto and Vulcan have to do their work. Do we sense them already doing their work?
Yes.
Yeah. So very trying times before the Christ comes. And of course, not all the crystallizations will be broken away, but enough of them to make his emergence possible. You know, last night I didn't really realize that I would be talking so much about the reappearance of the Christ. But when I thought of the opportunity and of the people gathered, and that it's really the most important thing, it seems like, and that we're just in the lead up to the Christ Festival, it seems like one has to use those opportunities to alert people, or to re-alert them, to what's really important on our planet now. I don't think we know how important it is. I think the day will come when we're able to see how close we came to the edge of the cliff, frankly. You know, D.K. told us later about 1942, the winter of 42, about how humanity almost went under right at that time. He wrote, obviously, afterwards about it. And I think we're going to get through this, but I think that he'll tell us about when the time was really dire. And I think that we're living through those times now, actually. So our decisions, even as individuals, start to become very important. There's more responsibility upon us than we know.
Cultivate responsiveness to the great ones. Aim at mental expansion and keep learning. Think, whenever possible, in terms abstract or numerical. And, by loving all, work at the plasticity of the astral body. In love of all that breathes comes capacity to vibrate universally. And in that astral pliability will come responsiveness to the vibration of the great Lord.
It's a beautiful, a very beautiful paragraph, and I just thought of something, you know, Gemini, love wisdom, lower world, and the breath. It seems to me, I felt it downstairs a little bit today, that under Gemini, it is possible to get the feeling of the love of all that breathes, literally that breathes. Because when you think of Gemini, you think of the oscillation of the breath, and you think of this one breath going on through all the breathers. And under this influence, the love energy seems to go along these lines of relationship to all that breathe. I think this could be made more real for us during these next number of days. I got the sense of that very definitely. You know what I mean?
Michael?
Yes.
So the breathes, do you mean that people with lungs, or beings with lungs, or do you also mean
it's everything? Yeah, it's just exchange of energy.
Yes.
That's breathing. Yeah, sure, there's lungs, but it is simply the energy exchange. We're all exchanging energy with each other, so everything is breathing. I don't know the manner in which the rocks breathe, but I'm sure there's some exchange, you know. So let's just say not only creatures with lungs. But, you know, I sometimes like to think of myself, or think for myself, of one breath occurring in many breaths, and of one heartbeat occurring in all the many heartbeats. as if everybody is being breathed, and the heart that's beating is a much greater heart than the individual hearts, and they are all just reflecting that one heartbeat. I like to think of one process going on. And then it gives me a feeling of unanimity, union in the one soul. And I got, you know, because what did we say this morning? There was a particular phrase in the meditation about Gemini, which I thought was very evocative. And if I could, it was on the light of interplay. It is the conscious light of that relationship. Line of light beams revealing that which opposes or a basic duality of manifestation of spirit and form, the conscious light of the relationship between spirit and form. I got the idea of living beams of light connecting the poles and the livingness of all connections in this unity. And I thought to myself, if Waysack is good for appreciating the absolute synthesis of Shambhala, then the festival of the Christ is very good for appreciating the living relationships in the unity and being part of that, the love aspect.
I think especially that feeling you can get when you get out in nature. When you have this response or this sharing something of the vibration. And especially now when you have the springtime, where it's like you feel it much more.
Yes, I think that's very much the case, indeed.
I think a good word would be prana, really, when it comes to the breath.
Well, and prana, of course, prana is a very Geminian kind of thing. You know, the exchange of the pranas. Gemini is one of those signs that rules the etheric body. So, prana and Gemini, and you see.
Connected to all the air signs. In Aquarius, we are sharing the air, the prana.
Did you say hearing or?
Sharing.
Sure, yeah. Yes. Yes, they all are air indeed, as you say. Of course, Gemini does rule the lungs particularly, but let's just say the subtle breath with Aquarius. Exchange of energy. Okay. Energy exchange. So I think there's big hints in this. He's asking us really to use the mind, but to work at a fluid astral body, which Neptune, Jupiter, and Venus would give us, and in the love of all that breathes. I think that's so beautiful. And this is beautiful, the capacity to vibrate universally in relation to the entire solar system, all life. So I think important hints are being given about what we can achieve under Gemini. And I feel it. I feel it in the air. Okay. Hints to achieve under. Yes.
Could I understand what I was... I got kind of impression during the meditation.
Yes.
Right at that point, the light of interplay.
Yes.
I was in this landscape. It was like snow, but it was really silver snow.
Okay.
Snow made of silver.
How interesting.
And people, lots of people were walking together, and they were all... walking in the shape of a five-pointed star. And they were kind of leaving things behind and walking towards something in a very vast, long way ahead.
Yes.
And at that end there was this portal into a castle or through the two pillars of the Gemini.
Uh-huh, very beautiful.
And the people, they were throwing balls at each other, of these silver snow.
Oh, okay.
And sort of play.
Playfulness. Yeah, playfulness. Yes. Unusual vision. Very, very, very interesting. Appealing. What do you think it's like when a person has astral pliability? What does that suggest to you? Pliability. This word. It's just the opposite of the six-ray situation, isn't it? We can get so much rigidity on the six-ray. And so much responsiveness under the Gemini influence. I think this has to do with flexibility, responsiveness, tolerance, ability to interact, interplay. Did you say
compassion?
Mm-hmm. Responsiveness. We can vibrate. I sometimes wonder to myself, how does the great Lord manage to love everyone? How? And I think it must be his capacity to relate to everyone, to somehow find them in the love. Love. He finds them in the love. And he doesn't let them, I was thinking, he doesn't let anybody out of his love. They all get included. He finds a way to relate to every human being on the basis of love. I should say not all, I should say every. Every. Because it seemed in the old days he could talk to anyone. It didn't make any difference who you were. When he met you, he knew you. He had a point in common with you. He had some kind of universality of understanding which could establish rapport. Gemini again.
Communication.
Yes. In the field of love.
Do you not think, Michael, also that it means the pliability? Do you think it could also mean agility to move within the planes of existence? Rather than just be earthbound,
agility.
It sort of indicates that it might mean a.
Yes, except that he does talk about the astral body. Mm. So if you want to apply it like this, pliability, well, I think I get what you're saying here, and I think what I'm reading is about the ability to be, to have a mobile point of consciousness. With in relation to the various planes. But I think he's talking about a particular kind of loving responsiveness in the astral body, if I can talk it that way. And I'm sure we've all had the experience of what that's like. Like there might be days when you feel you can relate to anyone. That you can find something in them to which you can relate in a loving manner. And then there are other days when judgment comes in and criticism and I don't have anything in common with that person and all the rest of it. But finding something, a point of commonality with everyone.
There's a connection between love and air. Because air has these qualities.
Air has
all. Has the same qualities as we are giving love.
Yeah.
Which we are describing love.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. The, for instance, in the vegetable kingdom, you have this pliability to come in.
Yeah.
Still there, but it can come. Smoothing. There's something in the air.
Yeah, the air, the air is the principle of relationship. It touch one, touch all, and sharing. I don't know how discriminating we're being, but probably some of the same air you're breathing, I'm breathing. It has a way of getting around. Yeah. And we just read this the other day too. The air is life. The air is God. And of course, air is in a way pranic vitality. That's why the breathing exercises are working, because via that highest element, we are able to electrify the lower aspect of ourselves. Okay. I'm waiting for this stuff to get off my vocal cords. I'm sorry, but it may be a very silent fifth day. So, go ahead, please.
This summation of process and of the forms is equally true of God and His cosmic creative work, of the soul, as it builds its instrument for expression, either unconsciously in the early stages or consciously in later, but the disciple, as he seeks to express his realization of the work through group work and the organization of his life, and of perfected man, as he learns through experience to center his forces on the mental plane, and from there accomplish his purpose in generating and producing those thought forms which mould the minds of men and embody in themselves that aspect of the universal mind which is needed for the right production of that immediate fraction of the plan which his age and generation require.
That's one of DK's marvelous synthetic sentences. Every once in a while he just wraps things up, and this is just perfect. Relating us back to that discussion of what is the universal mind doing in our meditations. And here we have the, with great clarity. And this is the summary of the creative process, and he said, Rule 9 is exactly that. A complete summary of the creative process. Let's look back here for a minute. Ah, that might help. Oh, thank you. There's a thought. Very nice. I felt also this morning that when we visualize the hierarchy and offer them our salutations, and by the way, I'm not making that up. DK has that in a number of his meditation. Those ohms and the salutations. That's his form. I felt that there was a potential to interact with the hierarchy. That there was a feeling of possible responsiveness with them, interplay. And that we were, when speaking the invocation with them, quite close, really. A part of the same process. So, there's something about Gemini which, because it emphasizes these lines of living relationship, really does bring you close to these higher lives. and you can feel it. And you realize we're all part of the same network of living, loving light. Now, let's go back to what you read. This I find very interesting. Very interesting sentence. Interestingly, intuition. Ing. What does this mean? The soul builds this instrument unconsciously in the early stages and consciously later. Is he talking about the solar angel? Because in a way, does it mean that the solar angel is ignoring the process of incarnation and just letting other laws take care of it? Or does it mean that there is a part of the soul, the human soul, which at first is not able to build the instrument consciously, but later develops the capacity to do so? Does it mean at first that the newly individualized human being is still quite unconscious and has not consciously merged with the consciousness of the solar angel that knows everything, but that later this human soul, even between incarnations, is able to be absorbed into the consciousness of the solar angel, which sees back several lives, forward several lives, and can therefore plan consciously the next incarnation along with the solar angel? Because that's a very amazing statement, that the soul is building unconsciously. What in the world does it mean? So it arrests my attention. Because there was a place where he tells us that at a certain point in evolution, we can participate in the preparation of our next life. Somewhere in Letters on Occult Meditation, we can be involved in planning our next life. I'd like to find the exact, because it caught my attention. Because I said to myself, well, who's planning that life anyway, if it's not we? So some higher being is planning the life, but the conscious unit that we are is not yet capable of participating in that planning until a certain point is reached. Thus it struck me. So, are we, the soul in incarnation, unconscious for many cycles of the process of planning the next incarnation? And are we then just swept in? You see what this is going back to? Only later awakening and wishing to determine our own cycles. We studied this a couple of days ago. We're usually swept out into Lemurian physicality and swept back in with no mind and no astral. Then we're swept out again into emotionality with a reduction of physicality and swept back with no mind. And then we're swept out into mind, emotions, and body, and we come back, mind, emotions, and body, but we have no control. We're swept out. So are we, for many cycles, swept into incarnation with no planning on our part, but planning on the part of some supervising agency, which is the full solar angel? The full solar angel can plan what we, the soul in incarnation, cannot yet fathom. But later, we join in the pre-incarnational meditation of the solar angel and can participate in the foreseeing of our next incarnation. And all that to me is implied in what he just said about conscious and unconscious building.
It seems reasonable, though. If you're going to, if any one of us is going to continue on with the work, that it is almost, you reach a point that you would have to do that.
We are a participant. You know, I everybody says, oh, I chose my parents, I chose this, I chose that, before birth. And I wonder, how conscious is the soul in incarnation of what is coming ahead? I know there reaches a point when it is, but I think for many people it just isn't. And I would hope that at the stage we have reached, it is now much more conscious process, where we can be part of what the wisdom of the solar angel sees in the light of where we've been and where we have to go. You know, like when you're a little kid, your parents take you out on a day trip, you don't know where you're going. They go one place, they go another, they go another, you just go with them. You're not determining where you're going, you're being taken along. But later, the parent might ask you, well, where would you like to go, dear, today? Well, I'd like to go here and I'd like to go there. See, you begin to participate. So instead of being just taken along, you are more self-determined. And I hope that that's the case for all of us now. Yes.
I'm thinking about crisis. Crisis can come in from personality level.
Yeah.
And they can come from the soul level.
Yes.
And the question is, do we recognize when they come from soul level?
Right.
So
and how would you discriminate between those two kinds of crises? Because it is a question, you know. I think, you know, let's just say, any personality crisis can be made into a soul crisis if it's handled with the right kind of consciousness. But, you know, let's just say you have a crisis, you lose your job, you lose your income, you lose your house, you get a divorce, you know, any of those things. That's called a personality crisis. But a soul crisis is one that seems to be staged to help you take a definite step forward in consciousness. You might go through a bunch of personality crises and not change your consciousness at all. Could happen. You just succeed in overcoming the difficult.
I think it's a personality who take the, as a, you can be crisis free. Take the challenge and make every, as you say, every crisis,
right,
to a soul crisis, so you can expand your consciousness.
Yeah.
You can learn about it at some level. Is it the personality who decide what this crisis can be?
If you're there.
Yeah.
In other words, if you're one of those people who is interested, we read it the other day, in understanding, not just so much doing, but in understanding the meaning of things, then you can take any personality crisis and make it into a soul. But sometimes I think the soul stages things so that you can hardly get out of the difficulties without really learning something. Remember that Scorpio stages the release of Leo. The word stages is in there. Sometimes the soul arranges things. So I think that it's not a cut and not a clear line of demarcation. What is a personality crisis? What is a soul crisis? But it's also possible to go through a soul crisis and people looking at your personality don't see any change. The personality seems to be going along as it is, but internally something decisive is happening. And no one would know, except for your own process.
I don't know if it helps in a crisis to listen to the intuition, because it seems like if you don't listen to it, there's really a crisis. Mm. But if you listen to the intuition, maybe you are helped in the steps ahead, if you don't know what's going on.
Let's go to Gemini. Hercules faced 5 tests in Gemini. The very first test he failed because he failed to listen to Nereus, his intuition. He was not guided by his own inner understanding. He ignored the voice. And probably because he did, he went on into a lot of other complicated situations where he failed 3 times and succeeded 2. So I think you're right. This is a beautiful summary sentence. He says it's true of all of these different beings. What is true of them? This is the whole white magic process underlined. That's it right there. He learns to experience to center his forces on the mental plane. Every magician must. And there accomplish his purpose in generating and producing those thought forms which mold the minds of men and embody in themselves that aspect of the universal mind which is needed for the right production of the immediate fraction of the plan which his age and generation require. It's absolutely epitomized right there. Whatever we create, it better be an aspect of the universal mind which is now needed to make sure that a fraction of the plan which we can help with can be externalized or manifested. So, you know, I think a very good thing to do is to say, well, what am I doing of service in my life? And I know it's good. Okay, it's good. I'm helping someone. But in what way is it really a fraction of the plan? How precisely so is it a fraction of the plan? Why is this little piece leading to the evocation of love, the revelation of love, the illumination of the mind, or the evocation of the will? Or as I discussed last night, how is this little thing I'm doing leading to the revelation of the lines of cleavage, the bridging of the lines of cleavage, the approach of the hierarchy, or the externalization of the hierarchy, or the reappearance of the Christ? Those are the immediate factors of the plan. Because to get specific about this is important. We can have a general idea that we're doing good, but if we can see just how we're doing good, power will be added and effectiveness in our service. Now I would say,
but we do it all the time when we sound the great invocation, because it's restored the plan to earth.
So
those little voices gather together, and it does work. It will work.
Yeah, I, of course, that is correct. I was just thinking about your vocation, your work in the world, the service which you perform on behalf of humanity. What little place in the divine plan does it uphold? It's part of getting the vision clear. And I would say it's going to fit more or less under one of the three main headings: the revelation of love, the illumination of the mind, we do a lot of that, or the evocation of the will. In general, under one of those headings, which you could call the three departments of hierarchy. In which department of hierarchy do you find yourself working? Or there's a little overlap, of course. But generally in our groups, it's not the political department. Well, sure, we have a respect for that. We understand it. But we are not particularly political workers, the majority. Here and there, some people in our groups would have a resonance with that. But mostly it's in the department of civilization or the department of the bodhisattva, mostly. So that's the big categories. And then you try to take it down and look at all those 10 C groups and the 7 different ways of working in service until you find yourself. And having found yourself, you work with greater power because you don't waste energy doing what's not yours. You do what's yours. Of course, we're such a second-rate group. So obviously, that limits it right there.
That's not a bad thing.
No. And it's a good thing we're reinforced by the presence of a few other rays here and there. I sometimes think a pure second-rate group would be a disaster. I have only to remember what Alice Bailey said about how Foster Bailey prevented her from making some very serious legal mistakes. Because he knew the law, you know, first ray. And she was just a second ray wanting to do something. So we're all reinforced by each other. Okay.
All these various applications of the rule could be elucidated and enlarged upon. Our problem, however, must be kept clearly in mind. We are conscious souls, or in process of becoming conscious. We are beginning, through our meditation work and our application to study, to work on mental levels. We are creating forms continuously, pervading them with energy, and sending them out to fulfill their function, in line with our realized subjective purpose.
We'll stop there just for a minute. Do you notice anything interesting about how DK is addressing us?
It's our.
Yeah. We, he's showing his identification with us. He's way beyond this. But just like the Christ retakes the first initiation with every new first degree initiate, DK is identifying with us in all that we are doing as if he's doing it too. He doesn't say, you are beginning to work on mental levels. You are doing that. No. And I think that's so instructive about how to approach people when you're trying to help them do something that you've already done. It's a very loving, inclusive, encouraging attitude. By the way, again, this word souls, I think what he's saying here is we are conscious consciousnesses. The word soul has everything to do with the soul in incarnation here. We're not talking about the soul on its own plane. And we are a unit of consciousness. So he's saying we are conscious units of consciousness, or in process of becoming conscious. So the diverse methods of speaking about the term soul have to be noticed in their various uses so we can really understand what he is saying. Anyway, we're constantly creating, And then, he says,
the emphasis should be laid upon the word realized in the above paragraph.
Let's look at it. Forms continuous, pervading them with energy and sending them out to fulfill their function in line with our realized subjective purpose. You can go on.
According to the clarity of vision and the depth of the inner realization, so will be the adequacy of the created form, and so will be the strength of life, which will enable it to perform its intended function.
So he's talking about what state our consciousness should be in when we undertake the creative process. Have we been communing with our soul? Have we responded to its meditation? If we have, we will have a clarity of vision. We will have, because we are communing with our solar angel, a depth of inner realization. And therefore, we will be involved in the creating of an adequate form, adequate to the intention of the inner creator. And there will be an alignment now with those higher soul and even Buddhic energies, which will strengthen the vital power. The vital power which is ours, and that will vitalize our form with strength of life. So that not only is it good form, it's a strong form. We have more than one thing to do here, right? We have to see the form to be built, to build it true to the model, and to make sure it is vital, living, strong, persistent, so it will perform its function. The three aspects are involved. Intelligence.
You missed out an L. Although mode is quite interesting.
Okay, right. Well, right, exactly. Thank you. Good. Be clear at the outset, do not muddy your conception, or the form will not be adequate. And that, let's go back to what we've been saying. Only if we are pure will we be able to register the impression from the soul truly. In the old sense of the word true, meaning straight. Okay.
Up to the present time, the majority of aspirants in the world express the results of little and weak thought with rapid action. The goal for students should at this time be rapid concentrated thought and slow action.
I'm always stopped at that. You know, these sentences always arrest me. No thought, little thought, weak thought, but let's do something. Compared with thinking it through and then doing it very deliberately. Mm-hmm. I always catch myself doing just the opposite. The first is a very myopic response, because maya is action. Unmotivated, purposeless, emotionally driven action without a clear directed thought. So he's really asking us to conceive it all before we do it, and then do it. Okay.
That slow action, however, will be potent in result. There will be no lost motion, no delayed reactions, and no tendency towards hesitation. The attention of the thinker being focused on the mental plane, the progress of his manifested thought will be sure and inevitable. When the idea is clearly grasped, the attention closely focused and the energy or life aspects steadily applied, the result will be irresistible appearance and potent action on physical plane.
It's very he's given us sorry, a real formula for successful manifestation. It, you know, it's so practical. So instead of having an unfocused mind and much lost motion, if everything is preconceived, well conceived, there will be what you call due deliberate action. And things will work out in manifestation. But he's asking us here to have real attention as a thinker on the plane of mind. The whole idea about magic is that we just cannot be an effective magician making our thoughts into realities unless we have a powerful mind. And, you know, the disciples of the modern world must become mentally polarized. It's not enough to just be wishful thinkers, hope that something will happen. I mean, you know, prayer is useful, supplication is useful, and all of that. But finally, to have a grasp on our own mental process. You know, right here in the book White Magic, on page 473, he gives us those counsels that will one day make of us a master of the wisdom. And, oh, that's the wrong book. Sorry. It said, clean up your thought life. Okay. And the very first counsels, they all deal with the mind. Some of them look so very simple. You know, look at the world of thought and separate out what is false and true. Learn the meaning of illusion and in its midst locate the golden thread of truth. Here's one. Discover that thou hast a mind and learn its dual use. And then exactly what we were just saying. Concentrate the thinking principle and be master of thy mental world. All of them are about the thought process in the beginning. Number six, learn that the thinker and his thought and that which is the means of thought are diverse in their nature, yet one in ultimate reality. Act as the thinker and learn it is not right to prostitute thy thought to the base use of separative desire. The energy of thought is for the good of all and for the furtherance of the plan of God. Use it not, therefore, for thy selfish ends. Every one of these is about getting the mental apparatus into a fit condition where we are really the master of our mental world. And we might as well forget about white magic if we can't do this. And that's why he says that if we're ever going to be a true white magician working in relation to God's plan, we have to be a fairly advanced human being. Because it's only relatively advanced human beings that really learn how to use the mind. And then learn how to use the mind in relation to the soul. It's so simple in a way. We just have to do it. There's so many people in the spiritual field they just aren't interested in disciplining their mind. Mm-hmm. They, you know, what's meditation? Oh, it's not what you think. Okay. It's partially true. clever statement. What's meditation? But if we say, look, we want to approach the soul, our inner spiritual reality, in a predictable manner. We don't just want to be a mystic and say, okay, God, if you want to be kind to me, show me yourself, you know, when you want to. The idea is we want to know the scientific methods of finding the inner reality at any time. And that means mastery of the mental world. And then he goes on, and I've memorized all these things because it is the basis of it all. Watch what you say, watch what you think. It'll all come back, as we've discussed. 473 to 475. And I like what he says here. He says, these rules may sound too simple for the learned aspirant. But for those who are willing to become as little children, they will be found to be a safe guide into truth and will eventually make them able to pass the tests for adeptship or mastership. So I don't want to complicate my way overly much. I want to fulfill the simple things which lead to the goal, instead of wasting my time with a lot of theoretical complexity, which it's nice to think about, but it doesn't get you there. See, when the Buddha appeared, he knew all that stuff. He knew everything. He had an incredible mind. But he said, what does humanity need? It doesn't need all of the castles in the air right now. It needs to know how to overcome attachment and desire. And so he laid his emphasis right on that, really simple, so people could get it. And there's such a lesson in that. Have you ever read any of the Buddha's sermons? It's amazing how he talks in such simple language. I don't know all the Buddha's books, you know what they're all called, but I picked one up a few months ago, and it was just an incredible, beautiful, direct teaching. And I said, hey, he's got a sixth ray mind. Is this how a sixth ray mind works? I was trying to detect his sixth ray mind in his teaching. And I thought, it was so ideal and yet so simple. It was pure. And I said, could I carry out this, you know? And I felt, well, you know, it could be possible if I would just be clear, listen, and apply. So these counsels are so very important. And I just suggest that we take them in and do the best we can. Okay. Now let's see. I think we're just about at the time where we're going to take our little break. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll talk about the left-hand path when we come back from break.
coffee.
Now, what do you think? I told you about this, but I was in a place in the United States that says it's a restaurant chain called something like U.S. Eggs or something like that. And there's this picture from the 1940s of a very perky, well-dressed woman with a coffee cup. And it says, oh God, drink coffee. Do stupid things faster with more energy. And I thought, was this a coffee ad or was this a joke? Because it was obviously one of those old, it was an old poster, it was the real thing. The 40s, you know, it was dressed like the 40s and all the rest of it. And I said, was someone really having fun here, or was this a coffee ad? I don't know. All right, we'll take a little break and Come back.